Good afternoon to the morning church. It was a request on behalf of the Imperial PM congregation to have a social function in the afternoon. That was the basis for the switching of time this day, and I hope that their occasion will turn out very helpful to those who are able to attend. Therefore, they wish to have the morning service time if it was possible. I hope you are aware of the train of events taking place in the world, not merely one area, of course, but many. I was commenting to my wife coming to the congregational meeting this afternoon that the extended trips of Dr. Henry Kissinger remind me of the efforts by Neville Chamberlain shortly before World War II to try to stop problems from developing into a serious explosion. There were problems in Spain, there were problems all through the Balkans, there were problems with Austria, with Czechoslovakia, with Poland, in which the Germans were involved. And this man with an umbrella sought to prevent certain events from taking place that inevitably did occur. Now we have Mr. Kissinger having succeeded in Vietnam. Makes you wonder what the intent and purpose was. Anyway, we successfully lost that war. Now we are involved in Southern Africa. He says that the intent and purpose, of course, is not to enter into any area where he isn't asked to. So that's why he, of course, has not consulted with Mr. Smith of Rhodesia. But you know, the British handed over Czechoslovakia to the Germans without really consulting the Czechs at all. And what we should like to do, would seem, if Mr. Kissinger's program is carried out, would be to make a decision on behalf of a minority group in Rhodesia to have them all removed without ever consulting them. Now, I would have to agree that he has some precedent. All you have to do is look through history and see how many people have been removed without consulting them. And I am sure as a historian, Kissinger looks at that rather than at anything else. The question is, there's coming a time in the judgment we're going to sometime have a chance to ask those who were removed without being consulted. But this is a part of our involvement, and there is the Middle East with all of the nations that are there. So it would pay you to beware of the train of events. As people in Europe have been saying, that these things remind one of 1937, 1938, 1 to 2 years before the explosion of the Second World War. We had a very short fuse for the Second World War, a much longer fuse for the first, and it would appear a much longer fuse for this one, because we are in particular dealing with Soviet Union, which does not move any faster than it is sure of succeeding. Today is the Sabbath before the Festival of Trumpets. Normally, it would be appropriate to deal with a question of preliminary pertaining to the Holy Days or the Holy Day. Since, however, I will not be speaking again for a little while on the program. Mr. George Meeker has invited me to be in Chicago for the Festival of Trumpets, so I won't be here with you next Sabbath, though I will be here in the Day of Atonement to fast with you. If that's any encouragement, we can start a day early if you wish, some of you. For the suggestion of Mr. Dukoc, others. Anyway, there is a subject that is essential that we discuss. not because it pertains to everyone, but because there is the need of clarifying certain things for this congregation and for others, so we know what the responsibility of the individual, of the ministry. I am going through a series, handling each one perhaps a little differently, pertaining to statements that were made during the conference this last year in May. I would like to, without reference to the paper, discuss the question of marriage and divorce. The reason I'm not making reference to the paper is that it tended to be a summary of the material that off and on has been rather widely presented. You certainly may have the access to the paper. Mr. Cox has a copy, not necessarily with him. And I'm not going to maintain that what I am discussing was in entirety the content of the paper. It would be too long to read, and it was in some cases an analysis of the background material. It was presented in this sense more as a background paper and a summary. And I am familiar with the topic. And insofar as the intent and purpose of the material, I hope to be representing it appropriately, though I will be going in some areas beyond what the paper said to clarify other areas, and that's certainly the intent of the paper, to lay a foundation. In this case, there has been no reason for controversy. I do not presume that the ministry is in entirety on agreement in this subject. But if I were in any way in doubt on a point or two, and a marriage came up in which I was asked to participate, I would merely step aside and have someone else. I think that there is a graceful way of doing it without departing from the church and accusing the church of error when there is none. There is a graceful way of handling any number of things, whether you agree or not. It's one of the reasons why I don't appear in most socials for the church, because I can't stand the loudness of the music. I'll make it known that I'm not here to prevent and to bar anybody from going whose ears are deaf to it. I will extend only that much grace to that kind of thing which damages the ears of young people, and then we wonder what happens later on in life. The subject of marriage and divorce probably affects most of us at one time or another. It may not, in fact, be a problem if we have had no problem in our personal lives. Our example, however, is rather important, and the counsel of many who may have been appropriately and properly and happily married certainly could have been listened to more by some who made mistakes, and maybe some who were happily married gave very poor counsel to others and maybe shouldn't have been listened to in areas in which they have no competence to give advice. I don't know. But we've had a great many problems in the church pertaining to marriages performed in the congregation by people supposedly baptized, or baptized but supposedly converted, performed by the ministry asking God to be a participant, where the marriage has either, as they say, gone up in flames or crashed in flames. It depends on where the source of the trouble is, I guess. And we have to deal with the problem that in any number of cases it was the pressure of friends. On the one hand, from the outside, to put people together, perhaps we all play a role in that one way or another. And then there is on the inside of such a marriage very often the unwillingness to forgive. There is a way of approaching the topic, and normally I'm just going to go through the Bible and show you what the Bible reveals as we go along, but of necessity I must deal with the topic, let's say, from this end in time, and then take a look through time to see what God made known and why. First of all, we have to realize that as human beings, we can be subject to error. It is God's purpose to lead and guide the church into all truth. Of necessity, the concept of leading, the Holy Spirit leading us into all truth, presumes, by the very nature of the verb itself, that all truth has not been arrived at initially. Now, there are two things we must take note. One can go beyond Christ and introduce things that are in error. There are those who have left and have gone beyond what Christ teaches, and there are those who do not, on the other hand, who have left, who do not follow Christ where he leads. It is unfortunate that some seek to get ahead of Christ and go beyond what he will teach, and others fail to follow the light as he reveals it, or at least have the wisdom to discover where the church is that Christ is using, even though one may not perceive every point of doctrine or explanation to be correct in terms of reading one's own Bible. But you have a responsibility to at least let Christ make certain decisions in terms of the body that he is working with. And if he chooses to govern strictly, as he did on some occasions, and crack down, and if he chooses on others, when people become lax and indifferent and lukewarm, and not to crack down, that's Christ's own decision, the same as it is the decision of every husband or wife. In training of children, as to whether they're going to be severe or whether they're going to be permissive. And what Christ grants you as parents, he happens to allow himself, whether we realize it or not. We're going to look back, of course, and discover that sometimes there is wisdom in giving permission to see what is in our hearts. For there are times when people conform but do not really live it inside. And that time is past. And now, of course, many can do as they please and still have our fellowship for whatever that is worth. But the time of judgment is coming in which we're all going to be examined in accordance with what is in the Bible. And anybody else's faults are not going to be any excuse for you. In this subject, the church did make a mistake in times past by not comprehending the breadth and the depth of the mind of God as he revealed it in the scripture on this subject. First of all, having focused in on one verse, which on the surface did seem so clear that what God has joined together, man is not to put asunder, a definition was placed on marriage, which flew in the face of all other verses, on the presumption that Christ was revealing a teaching which must of necessity, since it contradicted others, in terms of our interpretation, must of necessity replace all the other verses in the Bible on this subject. Now, the fact remains that we should take a renewed look at such a verse, such as we find repeated on more than one occasion by Matthew and also by Mark and Luke. I will turn, first of all, to a passing reference in Luke. Whosoever puts away his wife and marries another, commits adultery. And whoever marries her that is put away from her husband commits adultery. And this is a simple statement, the only one that Luke gives. Now, we shall learn when we go through the scripture that no scripture is of its own interpretation. We have to view the scriptures, plural, the writings, in the light of one another, why God reveals himself as he does, then I think we shall have clarity. Now, we do have an emphasis without any question that whoever puts away his wife and marries another commits adultery, but no reference to cause is given. Shall we assume that putting away is a blanket statement pertaining to all causes at all times? That was, in fact, the teaching of the church. And therefore, whoever marries her also commits adultery. Now, we must recognize that when scriptures are brought to our attention that clarify others, we need a new look. And it is unfortunate when some depart, not really comprehending. I will turn now briefly to another verse in Mark, same subject, slightly expanded, but without all the statements that Matthew gives. The Pharisees came to Jesus, Mark 10, beginning with verse 2, and asked him, "Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife, tempting him?" He answered and said, "What did Moses command you?" They said, "Well, Moses permitted," suffered, word permit, "to write a bill of divorcement and to put her away." That doesn't happen to be the case. Jesus asked, "What did Moses command?" Now, Moses gave a commandment in Deuteronomy 24. But the Jews didn't like his reference to the word command, and so they said, "Moses permitted a bill of divorcement to put her away." Let me correct my reading. I skipped a phrase that's critical to it. Moses permitted, you see, or suffered to write a bill of divorce. If you carefully look at Deuteronomy 24, what Moses commanded was that when there is a divorce, it must be accompanied, in terms of the biblical divorce, by a written document to protect the innocent and all individuals involved. That was not by way of permission. That was by way of command. The statement is, if you do this, if you do that, then the then explains what indeed was to be done. Let a bill of divorcement be written. It was a command form. And that was to protect individuals. It was not legislating divorce. But it was legislating the written form of the document to protect any individuals legally or illegally involved. Now, Jesus responded and said to them, "For the hardness of your heart, he wrote you this precept." So we did perceive that there was hardness of heart for the writing of such a precept. But from the beginning of the creation, God made them male and female. "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they two shall be one flesh." So then they are no more two, but one flesh. "What therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder." I will stop at this moment, though there's a little further discussion, but I will interrupt here the thought. To illustrate his point, Jesus indicated that in response to the general question, "Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife?" Of course it was lawful. It was written in the law that a divorce exists as a means of severing a marriage. But they were trying to trick him into taking sides between the various schools of Jewish thought on the subject. Jesus did not then directly answer the question of which of the permissive or the non-permissive schools of Jewish thought is involved. He went right back to the beginning of marriage when he said that this idea of divorcing was for the hardness of heart. Why it was written in that form in Deuteronomy 24. Now let's look at it, he said, from the beginning. God made human beings, male and female, so that they would be attracted to one another. Now he says that in a successful marriage, and here is a lot of counseling if people have ears to hear, a man should leave father and mother, not bring his wife to his father's or mother's house. He should become the head of his own house. So they are no more now two, but one flesh. It doesn't say three. Now, by way of example, we draw the conclusion that the marriage as God had planned it in the beginning involved one man and one woman, not one man and two or three or four women, or the reverse. There is here an example. There is no law, only an example in this matter. Now, we pick up the story. What therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder. And that is the summary, and in fact, the basis for what marriage should be in the beginning. What God has joined together, when God joins a husband and wife as one flesh, man is told not to sunder the marriage. And we interpreted this wrongly as if the reference were only to a form of divorce. Now let me explain something further. When a man or a woman marry who both have been virgins, and if the man decides for whatever reason, temptation, intellectual vanity, money, I don't care what, that he is going to live with some other woman or frequent a prostitute or become associated with a homosexual, he does involve himself in the potential sundering and the actual sundering of such a marriage. The reference here about sundering does not exclusively refer to divorce. It can refer to any moral, or I should say immoral, conduct that can lead to the demise and breakup of a family. It is a statement that God intended that when husband and wife exist as one flesh, that there should be no act that would lead to the disruption of such a marriage. That's the intent. Whether by divorce, whether by adultery, whether by homosexuality, prostitution, you name it. Anything that can wreck and sunder a marriage should not be done. But human beings do it anyway. Now we have, on this basis, definitely a broader and a new light to the subject. Because let me tell you, if a man frequents, after having been joined to his wife by God, if he decides to frequent a prostitute, bring home a venereal disease, or decides to leave his wife, he has sundered the marriage, whether there's any divorce or not. So the reference is that man should not break up a marriage that God himself ordains in principle at the beginning, but human beings do it anyway. Now in the house his disciples asked him again of the same matter, and he said, whosoever shall put away his wife and marry another commits adultery against her. This is the way the marriage should be from the beginning. And if a woman shall put away her husband and be married to another, he commits adultery. Now, the reference in the first place was whether it is lawful to put away someone. And so we discover that as God has ordained marriage in the beginning, and his reference is clearly to the beginning, whoever puts away his wife and marries another commits adultery. That is a general principle that governed marriage from the start. Mark and Luke chose, brethren, to discuss what marriage was like at the beginning and what marriage should be in the church if we are all willing and able to live with the kind of forgiveness that is grace that God can make possible. But this represents only a part of the teachings of Christ. You see, as I have said before, when the statement is made, honor your father and your mother, it is left up to you, to a great extent, by reading the scripture, to decide what constitutes honor. And in the same way, when it comes to the question of marriage, there are many other verses that point up matters that affect a marriage since the beginning. And so we shall now turn to Matthew's account, which in a sense is found in two separate places. We'll start with chapter 5, since Matthew chose to begin with that too. You have heard that it was said by them of old time, 27, you shall not commit adultery. I say unto you that whosoever looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. Who doesn't say who looks at a woman, who looks at a woman to lust after her. There may be no deed, but there is in fact an attitude of adultery. Jesus is here pointing up the importance of the attitude, and the two verses that follow illustrate on the basis of the typical punishment of the time, that if you punish in the letter of the law, like a thief who has his hand removed, his left one first and then his right, so also you have to deal with the problem if there is an attitude, and you have to get rid of the cause of such a wrong attitude. But I want to point up one thing. What does this commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery, really say? First of all, the Ten Commandments do not always define what you think they do, unless you've given some thought. The Ten Commandments don't really define what God is. They do define His lordship, His action as creator. But beyond this, the definition must be found elsewhere. The commandment which says you shall not commit adultery does not define what adultery is. It presumes that you have a knowledge of the meaning of the word. Furthermore, and more important, the commandment does not define marriage. Listen carefully. The seventh of the Ten Commandments, which says you shall not commit adultery, does not define what constitutes a marriage. It only tells you that you are not to involve yourself in breaking up a marriage by the act that is called adultery. You must go elsewhere to find what constitutes a marriage. Therefore, Jesus did not go to Exodus 20 to define a marriage. He went to Genesis to define a marriage. By way of the first example, I hope that is clear, because this is important to understand. Further, we read in verse 31, new theme, whosoever, you've heard it said, shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. That's the command that Jesus said. Moses issued to the people. Moses didn't tell them or command them to divorce. He commanded them that if a divorce occurs, that a writing shall occur, so that no one could be injured by any act that might not have been appropriate. Now I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife. And here Jesus is defining, brethren, the terms and conditions of the new covenant. He is not entering into an argument with respect to the Pharisees at this point, as already has been briefly alluded to in Luke and in Mark. This is the basis of the new covenant. because he shows you blessed, blessed, blessed. That's the section beginning in chapter 5. Those are the blessings that are promised, as there were physical blessings under the old. But here you learn that whosoever shall put away, that means to divorce in the general sense of this term, to sunder by way of a legal document, saving for the cause of fornication, translated from the Greek porneia, causes her to commit adultery, and whosoever shall marry her that is divorced commits adultery. And here we discover that this is not the message of Moses to the unconverted Israelites before Mount Sinai. This is the message of Jesus Christ on the mountaintop laying the foundation of the new covenant, in which he says clearly, whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of porneia. I'm using the Greek word, and we should have a general understanding of it after some of you have been this long in the church. He causes her to commit adultery. That is, anything that is not the basis, anything that does not conform to the meaning of the word porneia is not a basis then for a divorce or a putting away, which is the old King James wording I'm reading, and does lead to adultery. Now, two points shall be borne in mind. One, we are dealing here with the question of the transgression of law. We are not dealing with the performance of marriage within the institution of marriage. We are dealing with the question of transgression. Let me clarify this further. When a man or a woman fails to live up to his or her part of the contract, this has to do with a matter within the law, within the institution of marriage. It has nothing to do with promiscuous sex outside of the institution of marriage. The issue that Jesus is dealing with here is the issuance of a divorce decree, so the putting away of wife for a particular matter, which involves transgression. Porneia is transgression of some form. It may be defined generally by such modern terms as sexual immorality. I think that's the best general term, so there isn't any doubt about it. Whoever puts away his wife, that is, writes a decree, except it be for some positive, direct transgression of this nature that involves a sexual relationship that is not permitted by the marriage contract, that person can be involved in adultery. But if it does involve porneia, then it is permissible to have a divorce. This is important to be borne in mind. Some who have left, unfortunately, have assumed that the church must have been inspired at a certain time and therefore needs not be led or corrected of Christ when new understanding comes along. This verse is in reference to the new covenant relationship and shows that a divorce or a putting away, and that's the basic word used in the King James period that is parallel with our use of the word divorce, and it's interchangeably used in the New Testament. Whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of porneia, this indicates that a divorce is possible, and the basis for such a divorce is sexual immorality, which is the general meaning of the term porneia. It may have specific meanings also. Having specific meanings, it cannot exclude the general meaning, because Jesus chose not to define it further, nor was it an issue in the minds of the disciples. We did not understand this correctly. we assume that whosoever shall put away his wife except for the cause of porneia meant that the marriage was irrevocably bound unless there was porneia, and therefore porneia had to be before the marriage. And we separated sexual promiscuity before marriage, which the Greek word porneia does not do. It merely means sexual promiscuity whether before or after marriage occurs. The King James usage of this word and the modern reference to fornication as distinct from adultery has led to, did lead to that misunderstanding in part. Furthermore, we concluded that this was an exception clause not for a divorce, which it clearly is, but was equivalent to the modern idea of annulment, which it is not. Jesus is answering the question of divorcing, and he is showing that the one legitimate basis for a divorce in the biblical sense, when a marriage has occurred, that in God's sight should not be sundered, but if there does occur porneia, then it is permissible. And Jesus here gives an exception for the simple reason that God didn't ordain at the beginning that there should be fornication. He ordained that man should live according to every word of God, and God was teaching Adam and Eve. And marriage, as it started out, didn't involve any exception clause. Marriage, as it started out, involved people who should not get involved with sundering a marriage. In the beginning was Jesus' reference. But knowing human beings and the damage that porneia can cause, Jesus does allow an exception. He says that here is one, and there has to be some valid basis. Here is someone who has sundered the happiness of a marriage by porneia, whether before marriage and hid it, whether during the marriage, because the reference fundamentally has to do in Greek with involving oneself with a prostitute. It can involve oneself with someone you don't pay for either. It can involve homosexuality, and it does involve adultery. All those thoughts are included because it has the general meaning of illegal sexual relationship. So we're learning something, that God ordained marriage in the beginning. He didn't exclude the possibility of an exception, but in the beginning, says Mark and says Luke, God did not include an exception clause because there wasn't any need. There wasn't any fornication because there wasn't anybody else but Adam and Eve. And so when Jesus is quoted by Mark and Luke, he is quoted in reference to the nature of marriage at the beginning, which did not include, but did not exclude, it just didn't address the question. But now, without any doubt, looking into the future, looking at the human family, Jesus recognizes that this kind of a problem may exist. A marriage that is otherwise valid can be so injured that, in fact, it is worse to live in a mental state of turmoil, to live without peace, than to get a divorce when porneia has occurred and to be free to remarry, because this is an exception that makes it free, the individual free to remarry. You see, God ordained that marriage should involve peace. Too many do not, but that's what it should involve. We'll turn over clearly to a reference in 1 Corinthians. If the unbelieving depart, verse 15 of chapter 7, I won't expound on this except to dwell on one thought, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. Now, the purpose of life is to create peace for others. But God does not intend that in terms of a marriage relationship that it should be other than a peaceful. That's the intent. I don't think anybody should argue with that point. Knowing that having been involved with a prostitute, with homosexuality, with some other man's wife or some other woman's husband, I don't care what the relationship is, that a marriage can be so damaged that Jesus builds into the new covenant an exception clause. This exception clause means a divorce is possible because he said this is an exception. A saving for or except for means that this is a valid exception to the prohibition of divorce. Therefore, this involves a permission to divorce. And it is not excluded by the statement, let not man put asunder what God has joined. This is an exception to that statement. This we should have seen before, but didn't. The church erred at this matter, and erred to the point of damaging individuals involved grievously, and we acknowledge it. And let those who want to leave, who are unwilling to acknowledge it, leave and live their own lives as they will. We're going to look at the scriptures as God leads us, and we're going to have it straightened out so that there can be no mistake. Now, there is a prophecy about people who don't grow in this very matter, as well as in other matters, and I think we should take a look. I've read it to you before. We'll turn to a statement. This is found in Paul's letter to Timothy. The first one he wrote, he says, chapter 4, the Spirit speaks expressly that in the latter times, and that is a term that does not exclude the day in which the apostles lived to the return of Christ, some will depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons, speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their conscience seared with a hot iron. Let this fit wherever it may. But some things that people will do who depart from the faith. This does not talk about the Australian Aboriginal or the man in New Guinea who never had the faith. This is not talking about the Protestant and Catholic world, who have their own beliefs in the first place. We're dealing now in terms of our time. It could be a reference to the Middle Ages, anywhere where these things have occurred. There will be some who depart from the faith, forbidding to marry, as well as involving themselves with meats and other things. Now, we have sects and groups in the Middle Ages and in modern times, in the last century and in this. But I want you to note that one of the things involved here is clearly the forbidding to marry, which presumes that there can be any number of approaches to the subject. Some might say, don't marry at all. Some might say, you're not free to be married, when God says you are free to marry. And unfortunately, some have taken that approach. The church itself made this mistake and was involved in it, forbidding to marry when God himself had allowed it. And we should acknowledge this mistake. Whether we knew it or not, we fulfilled it. Now that we know it, we correct it. That's why it's still the church of God. And unfortunately, those who think they are the church who have left are involving themselves in this condemnation. Now let us understand. In the beginning, God intended that no deed or action should sunder a marriage. But since human beings are what they are, whether they are reared in the world or in church homes, whether they're converted or not, there is the great likelihood of porneia, which can so damage a marriage, that Jesus said it is a valid call, an exception to the statement that you're not to do anything to sunder a marriage that God has joined in the first place.
a marriage that God has joined in the first place. Divorce, then, which God hates. We read in the book of Malachi, I think.
We read in the book of Malachi, I think we can all agree with that. Quickly flip to it, just before Matthew, as the King James has it here. Lord hates putting away, 2:16. The Lord hates divorcing, putting away. Now, if you can get along and live at peace and be so forgiving, and you both are in such contact with God that porneia need not damage your relationship, then the statement is clear. Let not man or woman put it asunder. But if that act can so affect your marriage, then you can divorce. That is an exception to what God intended, but it is a permissible one, and you were asked, in a sense, to use it judiciously, because you're also asked to be forgiving. But the ministry cannot try to force people to stay together where the marriage will explode later, and it is better for the individual to make the decision whether or not to live with it. But brethren, we are still dealing with the question of transgression outside of marriage. We are not dealing with the question of the state of affairs within the marriage contract itself. I've been talking to you about a marriage that God has joined, where there isn't any question that it is in conformity with the law of God. So at this moment, we're going to turn back to the earlier part of the Bible, and sometimes we'll look at a verse, sometimes we won't, but we'll take a general view. We already know in the book of Genesis that God set an example of the first marriage. Without defining it legally, he sets an example. Now as we go on, we come to an illustration of polygamy before the flood. That's more than one wife. But you will note that the man had two wives. There isn't any question this is in the family of Cain. The law itself, by which we mean the book of Genesis here and the whole first five books, shows that a second woman can still be a wife. Because, not that this is a perfect marriage, but it is a possible marriage. It is better for some women to be married than to live alone or to become prostitutes and beggars. It is better to have, when you have a state of war and 9 out of 10 men are dead, it is better to have polygyny, which is a more appropriate term, that is more than one wife, than it is to have sexual relations outside of a marriage contract. And God's law allows that to the point that even in the New Testament church and the Roman world, when young or older people were converted, there was no requirement for a man who had more than one wife, which was not uncommon in the Roman world and is not uncommon in Asia and Africa today, there was no requirement to put away a second wife who was legally married, or a third. No requirement, I say. We are further told that in ordaining the ministry and deacons, however, that a man should be the husband of one wife, 1 Timothy 3:2, and the deacon should be the husband of one wife, 1 Timothy 3:12. Now you can read whatever meaning you want into that. You're going to be judged for it. But the clear implication in context is that a man who certainly could remarry after the first wife died has no reason to be excluded from the ministry. But there would be a reason why a man who had 3 or 4 wives, that is 2, 3, 4, should be excluded from this function by the very nature that his example is not the perfect example which is expected of the ministry in terms of conduct and rearing of children, of alcohol, of purity of faith. And since God ordained a marriage to be between two, as the perfect example at the beginning, this is not a perfect example if you have more than one at the same time. The reference there would indicate that if there are some who have one wife, there are also some who have more than one. And we cannot forbid individuals to live with more than one wife if in societies where this occurs, it already exists prior to conversion. You have plenty of examples in the Old Testament. It is not God's way in terms of the perfect example that we are asked to seek after. Now, what people should choose to do if the one woman is not happy and she asks to be released, there would be no prohibition, in my estimation, for her to be released of that contract. But that would be a church judgment, and there would be my judgment that the unhappy wife in such a polygynous union, or polygamy, which is the common term, but polygyny is the appropriate term to define more than one wife, as distinct from polygamy, which can include more than one husband. And we're talking about this other situation. The other, where a woman has more than one husband, is practically unknown in society. Anyway, the New Testament presumes it is possible, on the basis of this example alone, not to mention the example of Abraham or David or Jacob, the prophet. It is possible for a man who has lived faithfully with two or three wives with whom he had entered into a contract while they were each living to inherit the kingdom of God, so long as he did not commit adultery, which was a sexual relationship outside of the marriage contract. Now, he's not going to be perfectly happy. Any Arab, I talked to them in Egypt, he would say, here was King Farouk, you know, and his four wives, pictures in the palace. And he said, you know, he had these four wives, but he loved this one. Now, he lived with the others. He should have loved them, but it's a little difficult. My wife would certainly agree there. But it is possible. Jesus recognizes that people who inherit the kingdom of God are judged in accordance with the circumstances in many cases in which they live. And societies where a whole generation of men nearly wiped out in war are better off with polygyny than they are with prostitution, where a woman has to prostitute herself to make a living. She's better off being the second or third wife, having her own family, and the man making a living than the other way. So God allows it by way of many examples in the Old Testament as well as in the law, and by the example of ordination in the New Testament. That is, as a contrast of one wife versus the presumption that there are others who must have more, you wouldn't have to single this out. Now, we must deal with some other kinds of problems. I'm going to read now for a moment a section of Leviticus, which will perhaps enable us to better understand certain matters. We will start with chapter 18 and take note that we are told, none of you shall approach to any that is near of kin to him to uncover their nakedness. I am the Lord. Now, the purpose, the statement here is in reference to sexual relationships. Here is a series, which define prohibited relationships that may be more broadly stated in terms of incest. The nakedness of the father, of the mother, your father's wife who is not your mother, verse 8, your sister, verse 9, your son's daughter. Now, initially, the human family must of necessity have been involved with marriages between brothers and sisters at the very beginning, and then half-brothers and half-sisters later, even after the flood. Abraham, in marrying Sarah, married a half-sister, which is prohibited here in the law. That's because genetically and biologically, as time has gone on, there are relationships that are no longer physically proper or emotionally proper. Let us suppose, let me make it clear so you understand another facet of law. Suppose you have a sister whom you do not know, and you marry her, and you discover afterward that she is your sister. This does happen. It has happened in this country, and of course in others it might also. The sister, whether the daughter of your father or the daughter of your mother, whether born at home or born abroad, verse 9. So it can happen, you see, where you don't know. Is such a marriage subject to divorcing? Now let me clarify a point of law. The implication of Scripture is that such a marriage, in the first place, is not lawful now. It was lawful for Adam's children, it was lawful for Abraham, but as God looks down in time, it is no longer biologically and therefore spiritually now, because it's defined in law, it is no longer lawful. In this sense, any marriage of this nature that is not lawful does not have to have a writing of divorcement in terms of the law of God itself initially. Suppose the sister were a virgin. Suppose you were. There's no porneia in that sense. This marriage automatically is not lawful and should be discontinued. Today, of course, human laws govern certain matters such as this, and a divorce would be involved. In the biblical sense, there is no such requirement. Now, of course, we're not dealing here with the obvious implication of sexual immorality when it was known. I'm talking about something that can happen when you don't know. This is the area that where we deal with marriages that are voidable by the very nature, I want to get our legal terms correct. When porneia is involved, a marriage is voidable. It's not necessarily void. Voidable means subject to being void, but not necessarily requiring it. All of these relationships, if no marriage occurred, would just be classed under the category of porneia in using the Greek term. But should a marriage have occurred at any one of these points where you may not have known, or where the law of man permits it but the law of God does not, as in the case of a man who marries two sisters, one in the lifetime of the other, these marriages in terms of the law are void because the law expressly forbids them. And no divorce is presumed essential. This was so understood in the church, that is the congregation of Israel, as we have the history down through Jewish period. Because the law automatically spoke clearly on the subject. There was no question. And if it had happened, then it was a mistake. You could be forgiven. If you did it intentionally, that's another matter. We have here then a whole series that in broadly speaking in broad terms would be in the category of porneia. But if, for instance, one or two of these were done without the knowledge of the individual, such a marriage in the first place would be presumed void, even though it may exist. And anyone so involved automatically has a right to leave in such a case. And we're not dealing with any violation of the law of God, which says what God has joined together. We are dealing with ignorance, if it was done in ignorance. Again, in the book of Leviticus, just briefly, looking at a whole area, you have a section devoted to this in chapter 20 as well. If a man take a wife and her mother, verse 14, it is wickedness. Norman Smith and I were involved in a case on our baptizing tour in 1953 where a man had taken a woman and married also her daughter, one after the other in this case, because our society doesn't allow it otherwise. And this was indeed a very sad relationship. I will not define it further, but here we're not dealing with the question of where a divorce is necessary, where God has joined someone together. These marriages are in their very nature at the beginning illegal. They are illegal. I'm speaking biblically. The law of the land might have allowed it. The law of the land may require a divorce. And now we'll look at some other areas so we understand that how God's judgment is given. In Exodus 21, these are the judgments which you shall set before them. In Psalm 119, we have God defining the nature and the importance of the judgments and the statutes and the laws and the commandments of God. What rights do a man and a woman have? We will take one that is directly applicable here. In our society, suppose a man were to acquire a woman, beginning with verse 7. If a man sell a daughter to be a maid servant, and she shall not go out as the men servants do. She shall be treated differently. Now, if she please not her master, that is, the man who has, in a sense, purchased her, if she please him not sexually, that's the implication, this man who has betrothed her to himself, then shall he let her be redeemed. Now, what is interesting here is not that God wants people to sell others, but if it occurs. Now, remember, the Church of God must judge many matters that have transpired when people were yet unconverted in this very matter. We do not judge, in this case, matters that are only occurring among converted people. Then he shall let her be redeemed, but he is not allowed to sell her. Even though he owns her, he has to allow her to be redeemed if she is not satisfactory to him. Now, the girl had no choice. Her father made a decision. But to protect a woman in a case like this, where a man sells his daughter and another man who buys her is not pleased with her after his betrothed her, the woman is to be protected in the sense that she cannot be sold by her husband. To sell her to a strange nation, he shall have no power. Now, if he has betrothed her, if the man who bought her, instead of living with her, gave her to his son, he shall deal with her after the manner of daughters. That is, he must deal with her as his own daughter. Now, if he take him another wife, let us suppose the son has this woman and takes another wife. We read clearly that her food, her raiment, her duty of marriage shall he not diminish. This is in reference to food, the general category of shelter, and sexual relationships. the three areas which any woman has the right to expect of a man whom she marries. A woman has the right to expect that her husband will provide food for her, will provide her with shelter, whether in terms of a house or mere bodily protection, and sexual duty. So that if he allows himself another wife, he must not deny his first wife such rights, even if she was bought by this man's father. And if he do not these three to her, then she shall go out free without money. Here is a case very clearly that expounds a whole area that is not even a question of porneia. It is not a question of porneia. It is not transgression of a marriage. It is the failure to live up to the contract. Now, in the world, it may require a divorce. In biblical law, there's no reference here to divorce. She has a right to go free. She can leave him. It would better be classified in the modern category of an annulment, but unfortunately, that term itself has its modern legal connotation. What we perhaps best define this as, that there are cases of fraud that do not involve porneia, but involve the failure to live up to a contract. And here, marriage is presumed in its three fundamental areas that a man is responsible for. Any woman, therefore, who is married to a man who, for either intentional or unintentional reasons, could, not must, but could go out free. And the reference is not only to her freedom in terms of ownership, it is reference to her freedom in terms of the marriage itself. Of that there can be no doubt. Now, in times past, the church required that if a man would not provide food or shelter, but only demanded sex, that the woman had to live with that man, and the church provided her with the other needs. That was, in hindsight, asking a great deal of the woman and not good for the man. The law of God presumed in the Bible a better vision than perhaps the church had. When a man has no way to earn a living, and cannot provide food or shelter, the church has a responsibility to step in when the man has no way but seeks to do so. This is why we are to take care of the widows and the fatherless, and as the church has defined it, those who are unable through accident, you see, to take care of a need. In that case, a woman has no such right. But in this case, a slave woman has a right. And if a slave woman has a right, how much more does a free woman? So we conclude, without any question, that there are cases where women have a right, and in this sense, we are not dealing with porneia. We're dealing here with a situation of fraud of another nature altogether that is not sexual transgression outside of marriage. It has to do with the performance of a contract. And when there is a marriage contract and one or the other fails to live up to it, then the other party has a right to claim that there was indeed a fraud, which is another matter altogether. You see, it's one thing to have a contract and then to go outside and violate it. That is adultery. That is transgression. going outside, to transgress, to go beyond the border. That clear? Jesus said that if there is that kind of promiscuity, then a divorce is permissible, not required, for reasons of porneia. But a contract can also, in this sense, be recognized as not being fulfilled. And we are not dealing with transgressions with a third party necessarily. In such a situation, a woman has a right, equally a man. God's law defines it here. Now, if the woman decides that she can provide her own living, her own raiment, and her own duty of marriage, and she just wants to have the man's name, that's up to her. The law doesn't forbid it if she doesn't act on freedom. But the law clearly indicates that such freedom is permissible. Further, it indicates that a man has such a responsibility to perform all of these areas. Now, although the definition is not given, it is obvious also when Paul addresses the question in 1 Corinthians 7, he says, defraud not one another. Now, in this case, it was intentional fraud. The man decided not to take care of his first wife. He's going to take care of the other one he thought he liked better. We're told not to defraud one another. And the defrauding there means to deny sexual relationship. Now, it is possible that there are women who want to live in a man's house, but they refuse to cook and to have any sexual relations with him. That is, they want the food, the raiment, the shelter, but not to submit themselves to their husband. A man, therefore, has also certain rights, as a woman has, to expect the other party to fulfill the marriage contract. And when a marriage contract within the institution itself is not being fulfilled, there is a fraud or a failure to live up to it. And a contract is valid, but can be set aside. I'll use that term because divorce is not in reference to this matter. It can be set aside at any point when individuals fail to live up to the terms and conditions of what the contract calls for. You see, marriage involves two things. It involves requirements and prohibitions. When you allow yourself the privilege of a marriage, you enter into certain responsibilities or requirements that you do for another person. And you also deny yourself the same outside of a marriage contract with somebody else. That would be porneia if you did involve yourself with it. When a contract is not properly lived up to, when it comes to this kind of marriage, the individual has recourse on the basis of this example without any question. And this is, of course, basically the same as the modern concept of an annulment. The modern concept of an annulment, in the sense, refers to the incapacity, intentional or otherwise, the law of the land doesn't always judge those points. There are cases where we bring matters to the world to make a judgment. When there's a divorce, we're sorry. We don't normally tell you why. It's not our business to divulge confidences. It's not your business to inquire of them. On occasion, we have to go to the court of the land for a divorce when an annulment might be better, as when a man marries two sisters or marries a mother and a daughter. In that case, the biblical sense, no divorce would have been required in either, because the marriages were not lawful to start with. In other cases, a marriage might be lawful, but there are factors which involve the question of food or raiment or duty of marriage. And in such a case, the law of the land not uncommonly grants the more graceful termination of a contract for other reasons altogether, which have to do with the matter of the failure to fulfill, either intentional or otherwise, a marriage contract. In this case, the word that we use, an annulment, is always a nicer term, even in the world sight. It implies that there were some problems that could not be handled within the marriage, some inability to live up to every part of the contract, not a part of our business. And in this case, the reason I am giving this general emphasis here is that God has graciously made it possible that one of our brethren here, or two, one who is no longer at this congregation but is elsewhere, had a marriage contract terminated by an annulment, even after a period of time, and I would concur with the judgment of the court of the land in this case. And we are very happy that God granted such a favor and that the word divorce was not used, because it did not normally fall in that category. Therefore, I do accept the responsibility of mentioning to you as brethren that Arthur Landing has had an annulment of the marriage, that we are not involving ourselves in a divorce. And it is not in the area of porneia, because that would clearly have required the biblical concept of divorce. And so we do have a number of examples that are significant through the Bible. And I hope in looking at a number of these, we have a general perception. There's one other at the time when we normally should be released. I will just give a quick review because it shows how the New Testament viewed this matter. In the book of Deuteronomy, there were statements about not entering into marriages with the Canaanite tribes that were in the land, for they will turn away your son from following me or your daughter, etc. It doesn't matter. Verses 3 and 4 of chapter 7. Now again, let me explain. These marriages were unlawful. Such marriages were unlawful. But they were nevertheless marriages. That is, they were legal in the sense that the law recognized them as marriages. But they were not lawful according to the law of God. When we have the possibility of divorce, a religion entering in as a divisive wedge. Now, at a much later time, Ezra and Nehemiah acted, when the community had been so deeply rooted in such marriages, to enter into a legal divorce procedure to protect the name of the Jewish community, and above all, to protect the Gentile women whom these Jewish men in general had married. Now, Jewish law tells us, and it would be correct, that Ezra and Nehemiah were not required to issue divorce proceedings in written form. They, however, exercised, on the basis of Deuteronomy 24, the right to do so in order to protect those women. So there would be no question that those women who were divorced in the case of the time of Ezra and Nehemiah would be free. You see, porneia is not involved. What is involved is a marriage that occurred that was legal, and the children that were born were legal. They were not bastard or born out of wedlock. It was a situation where children had a legal marriage, but it was not according to the law of God because it could jeopardize the religion and the culture, the survival of the nation. Now, necessarily, when two people are both unconverted and one becomes converted and not the other, the same kind of question would arise. Should the converted person, therefore, sunder the marriage because he now finds himself living with an unconverted mate? Because you're told here not to contract marriages with someone of another religion. Now, Paul's answer to the question is very simple. And I will end it because we could go on with other examples, but we'll end it with this so that we have a clear insight into the question. To the rest speak I, I'm picking it up in verse 12, not the Lord. See, the Lord had spoken, you don't involve yourself with marriages with the unconverted. But Paul says, in terms of he believes he has the Spirit of God and analyzing the law, he said, if a brother have a wife who believes not, that is, you're found to be married to an unbeliever, here is a marriage that legally existed, but in terms of the law of God, as it was given in the letter of the law, was something unlawful. Now he says, if you, man, have a wife who believes not, and if she be pleased to dwell with you. Now, the concept of being pleased to dwell with you doesn't mean that she's the kind of person who makes marriage unbearable. And anybody who would interpret that a believer who has an unconverted wife has to tolerate her under all circumstances merely because he's married to her is wrong. She has to be pleased to dwell with him, and that pleasure is not expressed by no sex, no cooking, but I'll take your house and your clothes, you give me. We need to get our heads screwed on straight so we understand what the law of God is talking about. Any woman like that is not pleased. She's taking advantage of her husband. And if a woman who has a husband who believes not, and if he be pleased to dwell with her, let her not leave him. Which means he must be willing to provide her with food and raiment and duty of marriage. So here we have where the question of porneia is not involved necessarily at all. You have a marriage that was, in a sense, in the letter of the law, unlawful, but it was legally existing. And in this case, if there is harmony between the two, since the Spirit of God is added, which was not then promised in the case of Deuteronomy, Paul says it is his judgment to let such a marriage stand, even though the letter of the law might have excluded such. And we're to judge according to the Spirit and intent. But and if someone turns out to be not of the faith, is not baptized or departs from the faith and is not really pleased to dwell and doesn't make the home peaceful, as verse 15 would indicate the intent and purpose of marriage should be, then such a marriage in this land would be set aside by divorce. In the biblical sense, it doesn't require it. All it says, that's all it says, let them depart. Because all that is necessary where a divorce wasn't required was merely to leave. But in our land, we have to be submissive to the laws of man, and divorces would be required where divorces were initially not. So when Jesus was addressing the question of divorce, he was not addressing any other case but the matter of porneia. He was not addressing questions of fraud within a marriage, intentional or otherwise. He was not addressing questions of marriages that were not lawful but exist. And you have to put all these scriptures together to get the whole picture. Now, it would be wonderful if we could have it as it was at the beginning, where all believe, all can forgive,
and no one finished.
Marriage started out with that kind of a family. But it didn't continue. And these judgments of God reflect the fact of diversity of religion. The inability, whether intentional or otherwise, physical, mental, emotional, to fulfill marriage, or the direct act of some sin. And since those things exist, the Bible gives us examples and wisdom and teaches us how we should handle such cases in all fairness. One other that is a very simple one, and I will merely refer to it because you should receive it with no problem. This is in Deuteronomy. I won't hold you beyond this 1:21. We have many cases, where soldiers go abroad and marry someone. In Deuteronomy 21, when you go forth to war against your enemies and the Lord your God has delivered them into your hands, and there you take the woman of another nation, and she doesn't ultimately please you in verse 14, then you shall let her go wherever she will. But you shall not sell her for money. You're not to make merchandise of her. And you can go on in this same area, which is very interesting in this connection. Deuteronomy 21:14 would clearly indicate that when we have, in some cases, women who are converted whose husbands were soldiers, and they just didn't like them after they got the living with them. The law of God recognizes that a woman who is not pleased in a situation like this, where she had very little choice, the conquering power spoke for you, so to speak, and you were taken back home. You know what it means to be a conquered people. You might understand the situation. Such a woman has rights. God recognizes that if the man is hard-hearted, that a woman has the right, therefore, to leave, to go wherever she wishes, back to her own home or in your own land, and there is no prohibition against her remarriage. Because in the first place, the marriage was entered into in some form of duress. Now you can take a look at many other places, and you need to have insight into why God says what he does. Because these are cases where porneia is not in itself necessarily a factor. Now, it could include, but not necessarily. That is, this woman might have been involved in porneia before. The presumption is she was not. There's no statement about her uncleanness. The implication is you humbled her. She was not impure before. So there isn't any question that God recognizes when there is hardness of heart. God hates putting away. This man married her. Nevertheless, God recognizes in the law, and this is not what the Jews were challenging Jesus on. They were challenging him on Deuteronomy 24, where no limit was placed on divorce, but only the requirement of writing it up. But these are all other cases involving marriages under duress, fraud, or something that should not occur because God has insight to say that this kind of a relationship is wrong. And these are all outside of the area that Jesus discusses, probably better categorized in the modern concept of annulment, though not necessarily equivalent to it. And I think we have to have that insight when we read the law of God, which is, in this sense, the mind of God addressed under circumstances you will find, some of which are parallel today and others of which are not. And if the church is going to be led by Jesus Christ, we are going to have to let him lead us through this book to see what God's mind is on very serious situations, such as on occasion do occur.